on behalf of my committee. I'd like to rub that in. Anyway, apologize not having a quorum here. I know it's expensive to have you sitting in the committee waiting for quorum, and it's somewhat embarrassing, but we're going to start this morning with House Bill 3015, which we heard yesterday, and Mr. Myers, you're here today.
No, 3015 we did not.
I'm sorry. 2592, I'm sorry. 2592. Just quickly, I assume that you like the bill and you want the bill and there are no
amendments. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record, Carl Myers on behalf of the Justice of the Peace Association. Thank you again for continuing this bill to today. I didn't believe that Judge Lemhouse would be here yesterday. Otherwise, it could have been moved. Yes, I do support the bill in its present form. We'd ask that it be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Thank you. Work session 2592. Committee, do you recall the bill?
Yes.
Yesterday. We're in a work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2592 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2592 A. Engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Objection. Motion passes. And let's go to 3015.
Who's carry that
one? Representative Senator Ringo will carry that bill with his consent, unless he.
That's fine.
Objects. And then 3015, public hearing, Representative Johnson. You are on. And I apologize to you for having sit there for so long.
No problem.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ringo, sir.
Did you see the reference to Representative Johnson as a cross between the Godfather and Queen Victoria? It was in the newspaper. I just
really?
Read that.
What periodical was that in?
I didn't make it up.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state representative from House District 31. The situation that gives rise to this bill came from Columbia County. It involves a constituent of mine on whose behalf I filed the legislation, a sitting circuit court judge and a former prosecutor. Following the conviction of a defendant with a previous felony involving a gun, my constituent, the judge, was divorced. The former defendant, with a penchant for gathering personal information on people he disliked, combed through the judge's domestic relations filings and came up with the judge's social security number. Needless to say, the judge was more than concerned knowing that this level of personal information was so readily available and now in the hands of someone with a violent past and the potential for a malevolent future behavior. While this bill won't help my judge, he hopes that it will help protect others. I want to thank Brad Swank for his practical and useful help as this bill moved through the House. I hope you'll consider it favorably and move it to the floor with a due pass.
Thank you very much. Brad?
Chair Menace, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the State Court Administrator's Office. We worked with Representative Johnson in the House to remove fiscal impacts from this bill and to make it work. As introduced, it would have just applied to the initial pleadings for domestic relations cases. It now applies. It will apply prospectively from its effective date. We can't do much to save the information that's already out there, but for filings from the effective date of this on, we can do something. We don't think there's going to be a fiscal impact, and I'm here to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions?
Chairman.
Council, hang on.
Excuse me, Senator Burdick. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Swank and I and the other interested parties did work on amendments to this bill to make it workable. Obviously, the court filing procedure is quite complex, and we wanted to make it as easy as possible for court staff to comply with the requirements of the measurement while keeping these numbers confidential. And I think I think we've worked out a pretty good compromise with the current language in 3015A. So I think it's very workable at this point. I just wanted to make note that we did work very hard to get that worked out on the House side.
All right. Chair Menace, I also want to mention on the record that one of the things that we need to do with these still is we need to get the Social Security number from our records to the records of the people who collect child support. Because that's one of the reasons that we get these Social Security numbers, so they can go to the Child Support Enforcement Division, because they use that in their collections for child support and domestic relations. I want that to be on the record.
Great. Thank you. Senator Burdick.
I think he answered my question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any other questions? There are none. Work session, House Bill 3015.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 3015 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 3015 and gross before the Senate. Unamended, a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? There are none. Motion passes. Senator. Who's hot on Social Security moving around here? Senator Walker is. All right. Senator Starr, would you carry this one for me, please? Thank you very much. All right. What else do we have? Lots of fun stuff here. 3107, what's the status of that one? Have you heard that one?
We did hear that one.
Okay. Work session 3107.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 3107 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 3107 and gross to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Motion passes. Senator Ferrioli.
I will, Mr. Chairman. Thank you
very much. So that bill is due.
So that was the bill with the relating clause that was interesting.
But not quite interesting, yeah.
That's right. We have plenty of relating clauses here that will make life interesting. All right, let me see.
I don't think it really matters.
I'm just trying to get myself organized here.
Not 35. Not 3039, because that's Bill Taylor's, so we'll wait on that one.
All right.
But any of the others?
3361. Hope we'll carry on 3361. Sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Frisch. For the record, I'm the legal counsel to the Oregon Medical Association. Three quick comments. You have my testimony before you. This is the so-called doctor apology bill. In times of distress, patients want to communicate with their physicians, and physicians want to be in a position to express compassion or concern, and this bill would allow that. The bill is in the mainstream of legislation throughout the country. There are a number of states that have adopted similar provisions, and of course, nothing in this legislation would preclude an express admission of liability from being introduced in a subsequent proceeding. With that, I would defer to my colleague.
All right. Mr. Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in support of House Bill 3361. We believe that in the practice of medicine today, being able to acknowledge mistakes and fix them is important and appropriate, and that this bill will facilitate that kind of an open process. We would urge the committee support of the bill.
All right. Thank you. Questions by the committee? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for testifying this morning. I support the bill. I guess I just want to clarify a couple things. If a physician makes a statement of sympathy or apology, I'm sorry this happened, that certainly is not an admission. If, on the other hand, a physician makes a statement to the extent, you know, I'm sorry I should have taken this test, I'm sorry that this procedure should have been done, then that is an admission that can be used.
I think the phrase that I like to think of is, I'm sorry I did this to you, would be a clear example.
Okay.
And I think we're on the same wavelength.
Okay. I mean, the examples that I gave are similar. I mean, you wouldn't quarrel with the admissibility of those statements, would you?
I think it would depend on the full context, but I wouldn't quarrel with you.
Okay. Well, what context would make the difference?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think the key here is looking at the totality of the exchange between the patient and the physician. The use of the word I'm sorry as a predicate to the rest of the statement probably puts it in the context of an admission if they go far enough to identify themselves in relation to an action. So I won't quarrel with you about it. I think that we're on the same wavelength about it. It's just so much the situations that I've seen are so clear cut.
Yeah. If the word I'm sorry is connected with a statement that perhaps something should have been done differently, then that might be admissible rather than I'm sorry, it was a bad outcome. That's essentially what we're getting at.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe that we're getting to that, right? I don't want to quibble with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Senator Burdick? Say the doctor amputates the wrong leg and says, I'm sorry that your left leg is missing at this point, that doesn't connect himself. When that patient sues for damages over the wrong amputation, they can still sue for those damages. They just can't admit any statements by the doctor. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that is correct.
All right.
They can admit statements to the extent that they are inculpatory. They just can't. A mere statement of I'm sorry is not admissible.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just working on Senator Burdick's hypothetical. I think Senator Ringo is correct. That statement, as you made it, would probably not be admissible under this law, but other statements that the doctor would make that were inculpatory or damaging to the doctor may be admissible. And so it's not that they wouldn't be able to introduce any statements from the doctor if they made an apology, but it is the apology itself that would not be admissible. Other statements may be admissible.
Thank you.
All right, great. Other questions? Work session.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 3361 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 3361 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections to the motion? No objections. Motion passes. And, Senator Ringo, would you carry on?
Thank you.
All right. 3520, public hearing. Counsel, you want to tell us what this one is?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3520, as I understand it, allows for a violation of a seatbelt infraction, allows diversion, which is essentially a training program to explain, I assume, why seatbelts are important and why you need them in order that you can get the violation waived. This bill was quite a bit broader when it first was in the House, and it was narrowed to focus on this issue of the seatbelt law to allow diversion in those situations. It's unfortunate that Representative Anderson isn't here to talk more about the bill. I don't know whether he has talked to you outside of the committee about the bill.
All right. Great. Brad, you signed up?
Chair Menas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swanks, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the State Court Administrator's Office. I'm here today, and I've already spoken to Representative Anderson about this. And we spoke in the House after worked on some amendments, but in this bill, as it is drafted currently in the back on page 2, line 3, it says, upon completion of the program and payment of all fees imposed as part of the program. One of the things that language does not do is make clear whether or not you intend, as a legislature, to include in fees as part of the program things like an equivalent for the unitary assessment that would be paid to the state or those sorts of things. And the reason I raise that, and we didn't do a fiscal on this because it's speculative, but it's the kind of bill that makes me nervous when we're asked to look at it. And the reason it makes me nervous is because the seatbelt offense is the most popular Class D traffic offense that there is. There are about 42,000 of these cited a biennium into state courts, and we figure roughly 45,000 probably into municipal and justice courts. So you're looking at an offense that's, 86,000, 87,000 of them cited a biennium. So in in a sense, it affects, it's a revenue issue, but we don't know whether by passing this bill how much you will affect that, but you can see if you affect this particular offense, it's one of those offenses that if you affect them substantially, you can have an impact on revenue. And like I say, we didn't do a fiscal because this bill sort of legitimizes something that some judges are already doing, and we couldn't tell whether it would affect a lot. I wanted you to know that we struggled with that and why we struggled. And I also wanted to point out to you that it was not clear in the back whether or not the state would get unitary assessment if they were going to this program instead of getting convicted. So those are two issues that I wanted to raise for you. I don't have a recommendation on this other than if you want to make it clear that the state can get unitary assessment, the ordered unitary assessment, you may want to make that clear in the bill. I thought those were issues you'd know about when you considered this.
All right, for me, I'm kind of drifting back and forth. The two issues, one is the collection of the unitary assessment.
Yes, if that's supposed to be part of the payment of all fees imposed as part of the program.
Right, it doesn't look to me like it reads that way. But
well, it didn't look to me like it did either, but Representative Anderson, when I talked to him, said it was his understanding. And I'm not going to speak for him, but when we talked, he said that he had thought that that's what they had intended.
All right. Okay, and what was the other issue?
Well, the other is, it's just nervous. I wanted you to know we didn't say this was going to cost, but I'm nervous because this constitutes over 50% of all the Class D violations cited are this particular offense and statewide, and just because it's this huge elephant sort of standing in the fiscal tent of Class D violations, it makes me nervous when people start poking it, and. That was it.
Makes you nervous when they start poking?
Well, it's one of those offenses that...
How about if I say I'm sorry?
Yeah. Well, we couldn't tell if it was going to have an effect, but it's one of those issues, it's one of those offenses that when you start changing things, you have the potential to affect revenues to the state and to local governments, and we weren't sure that that would happen this time, but I wanted to let you know that we weren't sure, but we were nervous about not being sure.
Do you happen to know, by the way, whether there are educational or remedial programs available? Or?
Some judges have local programs that do educational remedial programs. Carl Myers, when I talked to him, he was in here earlier, he said that he does that sometimes. They have a local program that they use, and I know that some judges, there are local programs that they use, but not every court does it.
All right. Senator Walker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but this bill, I think the chair actually said in response to a bill I was carrying on the floor the other day that this is the most ridiculous bill of the session.
That was when you were carrying it.
I was carrying it. this is dumb. A diversion program for not wearing your seatbelt. I would say to you that most people who don't wear their seatbelt do so knowingly. A, because they don't think the government should be intruding in their lives and they don't want to wear a seatbelt, much like the helmet deal with the motorcycle riders, and B, they just don't care. So I don't want to lose the revenue. I think if they're going to violate the law, which is very clear, we make it very clear everywhere you go in your driver's training that this is the law, then let's just fine them and be done with it. They're not going to learn from a diversion program. I'm sorry. This might be well-intended, but I can't go here.
Senator Walker, I'm not here in support or opposition to the bill.
It's not our bill, Mr. Swank. I understand that, but and especially you're waffling on, well, you're not sure, and this, I mean, it's like, let's just say goodbye to this one.
Just nervous. All right, Senator Walker, how do you really feel about this? Anybody else? Senator Bray.
I can just see all the new diversion programs coming up for, I would personally like one for speeding. Diversion program for speeding. This bill, even before Mr. Swank started talking, I looked at this bill and I just said, boy, this has the T word written all over it. I mean, I can't imagine. It's tricky. this looks like a solution desperately in search of a problem. So I don't plan to move this bill, Mr. Chairman. I hate to break your heart.
Well, actually, I appreciate your comments, to be very frank with you. I actually am an advocate of traffic school. You know, seeing what California does, they actually, you know, move people out of prosecution conviction in traffic school. And we don't have a very proactive traffic school kind of mentality here in Oregon. It's, I think, something we should look at. I'm not sure that this is the answer to it. But,
well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Didn't you get traffic school when you were a child? Didn't you ride those little tricycles and learn how to do that?
I only got traffic school after I totaled my second police car.
But they used to have it in court.
You totaled your police car?
Yeah, and then they told me I had to go back to school.
We want to hear more.
We do. We want to hear.
I want to hear the whole story.
Actually, the first time I did was motorcyclist flipped me off.
Uh-oh.
That's what started it. And then he wouldn't pull over. He was not a very nice guy.
I think you captured me.
I didn't, actually. I had a very sudden stop and a pull. Somewhat embarrassed.
Is it me? Spencer Neal.
Spencer, my best friend, yes.
Is it him?
No, he sued me before, too. Okay. It was a public hearing on 3520.
As you speak.
Yeah. Good old Spencer.
Okay. That was a house bill.
Anybody who doesn't know Spencer Neal, he specializes in suing the police.
Yeah, he's a motorcycle.
Bill, as long as he's here. Actually.
Does he wear a helmet?
Yeah, he doesn't like the law.
3389. Let's do that, since my esteemed counsel and...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3389 comes to you from the committee and the Judiciary Committee, and that Mike Dugan is here to talk about the bill, and Susan Russell will probably like to say a few words, too. Allows law enforcement to use presumptive tests to determine if a substance is a controlled substance, defines presumptive tests to include but not limited to chemical tests, using a whole bunch of specific terms, and I'm not too sure what they are, but... Marcus Region, I can't pronounce the last one, the next one, states that the prima facie evidence of identity of the controlled substance is one of these tests comes back positive, and the test was conducted by a law enforcement officer trained to use a test by a forensic scientist.
All right.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for scheduling us for a hearing. I want to add that I was over Monday morning, as you might recall. I've had two wonderful drives over Highway 22 in beautiful weather. The legislature is doing a lot of wonderful things, one of which is protecting our wildlife, perhaps not from drivers. There's elk and deer and all kinds of wildlife that we saw today, and I want to tell you I appreciate you inviting me to see that.
Mr. Chairman, I must remind the witness that we will soon be shooting him from airplanes if we pass the bill. So,
but not with machine guns.
Enjoy them while you can.
I would oppose that. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mike Dugan. I'm the district attorney for Deschutes County, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3389. House Bill 30, and seated to my left is Dr. Emma Dutton, who works with the Oregon State Police Crime Lab as a forensic scientist. House Bill 3389 had its genesis in February of this year after the ballot measure 28 failed. As you may recall, the Oregon State Police had some significant cuts that they made. Some of those were to the crime lab. The crime lab is a sole source provider for district attorney offices, for state police, city police, county sheriffs, in the forensics analysis of all kinds of different evidence, including drug evidence. It has been long-standing practice of local police agencies and state police agencies to be able to use a marquee reagent test kit, or NIK, NIC test kit, on the street or in the police offices after they have made an arrest of a suspect or have discovered a controlled substance or what appears to be a controlled substance on the person or in the possession of some individual. Generally speaking, those tests are quickly performed. They are color-coded tests where you take, and I think Dr. Dutton will show us what the test looks like, but you take a little bit of the substance, you put it into this cellophane or this plastic container, you break the ampule, you shake it up, and if it turns a particular color, it is a positive reaction for the drug that you suspect it to be. They are not 100% accurate. We realize that, and we understand that. However, the police officer on the street has the ability to not only see how it's packaged, but also has the understanding of what condition the defendant was in or the suspect was in at the time of the apprehension and the acquisition of the drug. Generally speaking, the person may be under the influence or will oftentimes, and much more often than you might imagine, simply tell the police officer, yeah, that's my crank, or yeah, that's my coke, or yeah, that's my pot, or whatever it is. And certainly at that time, the police officer can and oftentimes does take the drug, put it into this test kit, and makes a determination as to what the drug would be. Because of the budget cuts to the State Police Crime Lab, they were asking district attorney's offices throughout the state to do a triage in the cases that would be tested at the crime lab. And do we need to do a test? Can we get by without that test at this time? Can you make a plea offer? Can you settle the case before we have the test made? Each one of these tests that the State Police Crime Lab performs costs roughly $100. I'm informed by the State Police Crime Lab Director that they perform over 17,000 of these. Is that a biennium or a year?
A year.
A year. That's $1.7 million a year, or about $3.4 a biennium that is used just to test drugs. There is a statewide trial rate of about 5%. Most cases will settle through negotiation or otherwise. By allowing the use of a presumptive drug test as evidence in a drug case, we can afford to enter into early disposition programs with defendants. They'll have some assurance that the drug is what we say it is. We can get them into treatment earlier. We can settle the cases earlier, and we can remove from the State Police Crime Lab job the requirement to perform these particular tests. So I want to emphasize...
Mike, hang on just a second. My assumption is that you would have the test. It would be prima facie evidence. You would be able to get your indictment and move through that process.
Correct.
Without actually doing the testing from the crime lab. But I'm assuming that if you were going to go to trial, then it would necessitate...
If the case is actually going to go to trial, the Oregon District Attorneys will be asking the crime lab to do the confirmatory test on those smaller number of cases.
Right.
And let me point out, too, that this bill does not increase penalties. It does not shift the burden of proof. It does not impact or diminish any constitutional rights that the defendant or suspect may have. It does allow the use of a presumptive test as evidence in grand jury. It would allow the use of the presumptive test at trial. And it would allow the earlier opportunity for resolution and disposition. It provides an opportunity for the person to get into treatment earlier, and we can resolve the cases quicker. It gives the Oregon State Police Crime Lab, I'll let Dr. Dutton talk about that, the ability to schedule their scarce resources to other more important or more needed services. It does provide that if the defendant wants to have a confirmatory test, we can do that just simply by having them give me notice or give the DA notice, and we'll schedule it with the crime lab. I would also like to add that the defendant can do that anyway. Under Oregon law, the crime labs are required to perform confidential tests on behalf of the defendant, if so requested and ordered by the court. I certainly would appreciate your support. If you have any questions, I'm certainly open. Dr. Dutton.
Dr. Dutton, why don't you go ahead and testify, and then we'll open it to questions.
Okay. I'm Emma Dutton, Quality Assurance Manager for the Forensic Services Division. And I'm here today to tell you a little bit about the NIT kit and the presumptive nature of this test. It is a presumptive test. It provides grounds for a reasonable opinion that a controlled substance is present. These tests could potentially have false positives or false negatives. They're not 100%, but as Mr. Dugan was stating, that in addition with the officers' review of the controlled substance on the street and how the individual is behaving,
with all of that in combination, most of the time when we get these requests in the laboratory, it turns out to be what they say it is. Actually, I don't know of a time that it has turned out otherwise. So with all of those things involved, even though it's a presumptive test, with all of the other evidence that the officer has noted from the individual on the street, what the officer indicates it to be as methamphetamine, pretty much it turns out to be that in the lab when we do the confirmatory test. Most of these color tests are specific for the chemical structures, and therefore you can have other medications that could show up as a false positive. In addition, there would be tests that would turn up false negatives. That is, you would probably miss some. Even though it is methamphetamine or cocaine, it might not show up in this presumptive test. We use these presumptive tests in the laboratory. It's one of the first things that we do when we get a controlled substance case in, and then we usually follow up or always follow up with a confirmatory test. And our reports go out stating as such that the evidence has been confirmed as a controlled substance. We are a full-service laboratory. As Mr. Dugan stated, we do work primarily for the state. However, there is an Oregon revised statute, 181.08, that does say that the defense can, upon court order, submit evidence to the laboratory. This has happened in the past, and when this does happen, we have a division policy in place that ensures strict confidentiality between the analyst doing the test and the defense attorney. We usually do those types of requests in two separate laboratories. So if we have both the prosecution and the defense requesting services on the same case, the case will be tested in two separate laboratories by two separate individuals, and the confidentiality will be maintained. If you have any questions about the NIT kit, I would be happy to answer those.
Doctor, you raised an interesting question. If you have a request by defense to process evidence that's maybe extraordinary, or you know, in addition to what the district attorney might request, or do you charge them for those services? Even if the defendant is paying for their own counsel, you don't charge them?
No charge for the services. If the defense has a court order to have us test the material, we do not charge for those services.
That's fascinating. How many of those kind of requests do you get each year?
I don't know the exact number to that, but it's not very frequent.
Okay. I mean, usually, at least in the metro area, they go to Intermountain Laboratories or one of the other independents. But questions? Senator Burdick first, then Senator Walker. And then
I have this little kit in my hand, and you said that some drugs imitate the illegal drugs. So just going down the list, what is a over-the-counter drug or something that people might take that would duplicate opium alkaloids?
In that case, I don't know the answer to that question. For an over-the-counter medication that would indicate a positive for opium alkaloids, that obviously would be one of the heroin or the opiates.
Would poppy seeds do that? I heard one time that poppy seeds, you ate poppy seeds that you could...
In this case, you'd probably have to eat quite a few poppy seeds for that to indicate a positive. But if you were just to take a poppy seed and crush it up and put it in there... I couldn't say that would be sensitive enough to give you a positive response.
Okay. How about codeine? What would imitate codeine?
Now, in this case, that would be a prescribed medication, so certainly there are some prescribed medications that you could get that could show a positive.
Well, Mr. Chairman, back to opium, if you had something like Percocet or one of these painkillers, could that... imitate opium?
In some of the pain medications, Percocet, Percodan, Demerol could show up positive. But again, those are controlled, prescribed medications.
And how about amphetamines? Aren't there things that you get over the counter that would duplicate those, that would imitate those?
There are some over-the-counter medications that could potentially show up positive in that as well. But there again, you would have, I mean, we're talking the drugs and the packaging, so the officer's not just looking at the cardboard container of the over-the-counter medication, but how the particular controlled substance is packaged. Certainly, there could be somebody abusing an over-the-counter medication.
Okay, and then you mentioned false positives and false negatives. Do you more often get false positives or false negatives, and what percentage of false results do you get from these little tests?
I don't have the data for that type of indication. I don't think that kind of data has been collected on the street. Certainly, the reliability of the test when they do the quality control on those NIC kits in the laboratory, the reliability is stated from the manufacturer of being 95% reliable. However, there's not street evidence or results or data that's been collected to indicate the percent of false positives or false negatives that have occurred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Dutton, what if a police officer is blind, colorblind?
That would have to be at the discretion of the training of the individual that's having that officer perform that test.
And how quickly after you take the test do you have to take the reading before the color changes?
You'd like to, once you put the substance in, within, 30 minutes, certainly as soon as possible, and some of them look at the color reaction. Typically after 30 minutes, the color reaction is already completed.
And this bill isn't the one that's aimed at using this for grand jury testimony. That's one of the other bills we have, correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, there is a different bill that allows, I think it passed the House, to allow a police officer to testify based on the police reports of others at grand jury. Currently, Oregon law provides for grand jury evidence. You can only put into grand jury that evidence that would be admissible at a trial court level.
Would this be admissible?
It would be... perhaps admissible, but not as proof that the substance is what the test says it is. The officer can certainly testify that while on the street he observed the defendant and recognized the defendant to be under influence of some substance, did the search of the defendant, found this package material, it was packaged like methamphetamine. When he obtained it, the defendant said it was methamphetamine, and gave a presumptive test, and it turned positive. That test is not sufficient under the current law to prove that it is, in fact, methamphetamine, when yet the defendant says it is and the police officer observations recognize it to be and the presumptive test shows it to be. It would then have to go forward to the crime lab to have the confirmatory test. The crime lab then prepare a certified report and sent in to the state to introduce into evidence. In Lane County, they do not take any of their criminal possession of controlled substance cases to grand jury without the existence of the crime lab report. Other counties in the state allow the defense or the police to testify about the substance, the packaging material, the state of the defendant, and the statements made by the defendant, and take it to grand jury. So each county is a little bit different,
The gist of what you're saying is that if we were to allow this bill, that information could be used under the totality of the case, and even though you're telling us that there are false positives and false negatives.
That's correct. But
okay.
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, the generally speaking, if there was a false positive, the defendant would know that they don't have the drug that we're saying it is. And they could ask for the test and it could be confirmed and we can go forward that way. We've had, and in my experience has been that we've had more false negatives than we've had false positives. Police officers are pretty astute at recognizing the symptoms of drug usage and the packaging, and they're trained in that as well, so they're able to recognize fairly accurately what substance it is that they are wanting to be tested.
Thank you.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Could you step through one more time, please, the safeguard for a false positive?
Well, the safeguard is certainly this. As excuse me for improperly addressing the committee, Senator, Chairman Minnis and Senator Ringo. The safeguards are simply this. As Senator Burdick pointed out, if somebody had an over-the-counter medication and the police officer found it and wanted to test it, it would be an over-the-counter medication, and it would not be an illegal substance. The police officer wouldn't have any basis to test it. If it was a prescribed medication and it was in the packaging material that came from the pharmacy with the prescription on it, it would not be an illegal possession of a controlled substance.
Okay, but what if you got some pills in a bag?
Okay, if you have some
clear
pills,
plastic bag.
If you have pills in a bag, I think the example that we used by Representative Harper, or it's not Harper, Barker in the House, is what happens if a person cannot swallow pills and has to grind them up and snort them to take them, and he had some aspirin. Kind of an odd example, but he had a package of ground-up aspirin, and it looks like it's packaged as a controlled substance, and the police officer takes it, and there's a false positive. As Representative Barker said, I know it's aspirin. I'll ask for the test. So that's the safeguard.
And they ask the test of the forensics lab.
Right. In most cases.
And what's the reliability of that test?
Of the forensic laboratory test? We do the two tests. We do the presumptive test and then always follow it up with a confirmatory. And that is reliable.
The way this plays out is that your test shows, this is an example, that it's an opiate, and that the person, the potential defendant, says, no, it really is Advil. You can do a test to determine, A, whether it is an opiate, or B, can you test and confirm that it might exactly what it actually is? I mean, could you test to say, no, this is Tylenol, this is some other prescription medication?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the laboratory tests are tests that are for controlled substances, illegal controlled substances.
Mm-hmm.
While we may be able to confirm that it is an opiate or cocaine or heroin, we do not confirm for Tylenol or Advil.
But you do confirm the exact type of illegal controlled substance.
Yes, we do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, and in most cases, we're talking about a fairly small amount of controlled substances. And in most of those cases, the defendant is as interested in getting into court, getting his case resolved or her case resolved, and into either a treatment program or to a probation program or a drug court as soon as possible. This presumptive test as evidence bill would allow that to happen. In those small amount of cases that the defense attorney or the defendant claim that it is not the substance that we suspect it is, we're certainly going to have a confirmatory test. And in those even smaller amount of cases that are going to go to trial, the district attorneys will ask for a confirmatory test. This bill will save money, it will save time and scarce resources of the Oregon State Police Crime Lab.
Other questions? All right. We have Susan Russell. Looks thrilled today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we're here in opposition to House Bill 3389. And just a couple points that I wanted to make and draw your attention to. We're opposed for two reasons. One, that this bill is unnecessary, and two, that the test is unreliable, so declaring it by statute that it's the prima facie evidence that a controlled substance exists when it's based on a test that's unreliable is really going the wrong way. First of all, in terms of being unnecessary to save costs, we heard from Mr. Dugan about sort of the idea that this test would be used for early disposition or diversion programs. I think the largest diversion program in the state is what's called the STOP program that exists in Multnomah County. People enter into that program on a district attorney's information without an indictment. So in order to do a diversion program or an early disposition, there is no requirement that an indictment be had. And I think Mr. Dugan said that what he'd like is this bill for the purpose that they could then take this presumptive test to the grand jury return an indictment. And our position is that indictment is not necessary and, in fact, isn't used. What happens, I can give you an example, and there's thousands of people that participate in the STOP program. They'll be made an offer based on a district attorney's information. The drugs would never have been tested. Sometimes there'll be a field test, and sometimes I don't think there's even a field test that's been done. The person will get an offer to enter this program. They agree to stipulate to the facts. They enter into this diversion program. Many succeed, some don't. The ones that don't succeed, they've agreed to stipulate to the facts, and then we'll go to a court trial based on the stipulated facts. And in terms of the defendant's reliability in order to protect themselves, I've made inquiries of the attorneys from the Metropolitan Public Defenders, who are the attorneys that have exclusive representation of the people in the STOP program. And they have let me know that in these stipulated fact trials, it happens. Not with a huge regularity, but it happens more than exceptionally, that by that time, once they've failed out of the program and there's stipulated fact trial, the crime lab will have tested the drugs. And it happens that the test comes up that they're not drugs, that there are no controlled substance involved, and the person is then acquitted on a stipulated fact, and I would assume unbeknownst to the defendant who's entered into this drug diversion program believing that they were in possession of a controlled substance. So we believe that it's not necessary, that there are other ways, short of, you know, declaring an unreliable test a presumptive test for controlled substance, to do a diversion and early disposition program and spare the cost of testing the drugs. Our second point is that this is an unreliable test, and by declaring it, prima facie evidence.
Hang on a second. You're saying it's unreliable. Are you submitting any testimony that would, other than your own verbal testimony, that would document or provide evidence to that fact?
Mr. Chair, I think that this is the testimony of the proponent, of Mr. Dugan.
Well, but again, I don't know what your familiarity with the test is, and I don't know whether or not you have some research or some documents that you can submit to the committee that would demonstrate its level of unreliability. I mean, you could say that fingerprints are unreliable.
Mr. Chair, I think that the crime lab, I mean, we can, I'm not an expert in this. I think the crime lab, and I would defer to the crime lab and her testimony, the individual from the crime lab who testified. So I'm not indicating anything different than that. And I think it's her testimony, I think Mr. Dugan's as well, that this test would not meet current scientific evidence standards in terms of being admissibility. And you can recall
admissibility for what purpose? And I think that's the key here. I mean, clearly you could use it to get an indictment, but you're not going to use it to convict.
Mr. Chair, you're saying under current law you could use it to get an indictment?
Right.
Then we don't have any reason for this bill.
Yes, we do. $1.6 million.
But, Mr. Chair, if the purpose is to have this bill, my understanding is that the District Attorney Association is asking for this bill because they are claiming that without this bill, they can't take this prima facie test to get a grand jury.
That wasn't the totality of what Mr. Dugan said. He did indicate that it could be. He didn't say that was the totality of the primary reason. I'm looking at this. I'm looking at it from a budgetary perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You guys in the defense bar want more money in defense, in defense, right? We have a $1.1 billion loss in projected revenue since the beginning of the session. I guess from my perspective, the question is whether or not this kind of a process change would affect the legal rights of the defendant. And in the instance that the defendant was ultimately going to go to trial, clearly the test would be confirmed or done to confirm that, in fact, it is the substance that it's believed to be, and that evidence would be the evidence used to convict. So it doesn't appear to me to create a infringement on the constitutional rights of defendants. It seems to me that it makes the process much simpler in terms of moving the case forward. So, I mean, on one hand, and I want to argue the fiscal side of this, you guys want money for indigent defense. We've got a revenue problem.
And, Mr. Chair, I agree. And I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that this test is, what I've heard doesn't make this test necessary. I think your agreement is that the test is sufficiently reliable for the state to proceed through grand jury, in which case it's not necessary to have this bill. It's not necessary for a diversion or an early disposition program because You don't even need an indictment in those cases. So therefore, what is this bill necessary for?
So we could save money if we ask that the test be done based on the defense motion, or defense request. You'd accept the documents, the police reports, and testimony under the totality of circumstances to move the legal processes forward. And we wouldn't have to have this test either. You do the test once the defense attorney says we want the test done.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not quite sure
the process. Right now they're processing all of these pieces of evidence, and they're processing them in a crime lab to the tune of $1.6 $7 million.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
What you're saying is they don't have to do that.
Mr. Chair, what I believe is it's a policy decision on the crime lab and the District Attorney's Association or the different practices. I don't know if all counties are doing that in order to return indictment. My understanding with the counties that I'm familiar with, well, there's two different counties.
Well, maybe we just need to make it clear that we don't need to. I mean, if you're saying that it is currently the law, then maybe we just need to rewrite the statute so we make it eminently clear that you don't have to, and that the defense, you know, give the right to the defense to request the test and have it processed.
And I think perhaps that's a better way to go. Our concern is by declaring it prima facie evidence that isn't limiting to the sort of the grand jury process. It's not limiting to the drug diversions or the early dispositions. And there are, I've talked with Mr. Dugan, and I think we're at one in terms of the way we practice law. Is that he said, I think not exactly in his words to paraphrase, that he'd be a fool not to have the drugs test because a defense attorney would attack the reliability, would ask for less satisfactory evidence. But there are other counties where people perhaps aren't as savvy or as focused on these issues. And
I do agree with you. When you see prima facie evidence, it ultimately could be introduced at trial in terms of the conclusion, the identification of the substance. I mean, I don't see in the bill anywhere that it requires the confirmatory test that we've been talking about.
And correct, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So, I mean, I'm sure as a matter of practice they would do it because all the DAs that I've ever dealt with actually go overboard the other direction. So I've had consensual, sexual statutory rape cases where both individuals agreed they had sex, and then prosecution wants the rape kit processed, which seems kind of counterintuitive to me, but since they're both admitting it, but they do. Okay, so do you want to work with Mr. Dugan on this thing?
Sure, Mr. Chair, that'd be fine.
Okay, well, we'll do that. We'll send you out in the hallway. That clearly the votes are not in the committee at this juncture to move the bill forward. But I think since you're saying that it's currently okay to do this without the test in terms of moving the legal processes along, maybe you can rewrite the statute and we'll just make it eminently clear that you can do that. So, okay. Senator Rigmore.
Your second argument is that it's unreliable, and you accept that their assertion that it's 95% reliable. You just don't think that's high enough.
Mr. Chair, there's two ways it's unreliable. One, I guess here's the problem is with the reliability. First of all, it depends on the test itself. So it's got a 5% error for a test for someone who's properly trained. And we've had mentioned, I think, by Senator Walker, or it might have been Vice Chair Burdick, about colorblindness. The other issue is that this is a test that it doesn't last. It's gone within a few seconds. So it depends upon the subjective interpretation of the officer. So it's our position increases the unreliability of the test.
Well, I guess I'd like to know what then you believe to be the true reliability. Can you state a number? I mean, are these 50% reliable then, or 80%, or? You're thinking as administered, it's less than 95.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringel, yes.
Okay.
So
what do you think it really is now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringel, I don't know. I don't know of any information on that in terms of being conducted to say as applied in the field.
Let's say they were administered properly and there's a 95% accuracy rate. Is that good enough, or do you want 98%, 99%? What's a reliable test for you?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringel, I guess our concern is not with the test. The concern is with the legislator declaring that it's prima facie evidence, making a declaration. At present, a case could proceed and go to trial, and the state could proceed simply on this test. and it would be a matter for the parties to argue to the jury. But I think that the concern is by declaring it a prima facie test, that there's some implication it's given is that the legislator has decided that this is...
Well, that's a different than reliability argument, though.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringel, I think the reliability goes to the issue of whether or not the... I mean, our objection here is primarily that the legislators be declaring it a prima facie evidence. And there's many different forms of evidence that people use to prove other things, for example. But the legislature doesn't say, well, a defendant's eyes being dilated is prima facie evidence that the defendant is under the influence of this narcotic. Those are things that are argued before a trial court and a jury. And so...
So if there was not a problem with administering it, if it had a 99% accuracy rate, you would still have a problem with it because of the prima facie issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringel, I just... It seems unusual and exceptional that the legislature would declare that one matter is prima facie, one type of evidence is prima facie evidence of guilt, when in all other areas that is a matter that's submitted to the court and to the fact finders. We don't declare that a witness is reliable and is prima facie evidence. It's just peculiar.
Mr. Chair, I don't mean to beat this. I just, it doesn't seem to me then that the heart of your objection is the reliability. It doesn't seem to me that's the heart of your objection.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringel, it's our concern connected, it's our concern with reliability when the legislator is considering the next step of declaring that it's prima facie evidence. It's not, we're not asking the legislature not to allow this in evidence because it's not sufficiently reliable, just that there shouldn't be a declaration.
Following on Senator Ringel's question, it kind of falls on mine. I mean, and I would agree with you, when we do declare a particular piece of evidence prima facie, this doesn't restrict the use of it as prima facie evidence at trial, right? And I would agree with you. I would think that once you get to trial, you probably should have, probably statutorily designated, that the confirmatory test would have had to have been accomplished and come back positive, because the way the bill is written now, you could take it to trial without the confirmatory test and make that argument. I don't think it would be very wise for prosecutor to do that, but the way the bill's written, it would allow that to occur. Senator,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Russell, it's been a long time since I did trial work, but my recollection is you'd just love to have a DA take this kind of test into court. If you couldn't convince the trier of fact, you could surely convince the Court of Appeals of its unreliability for the purposes of proving the case. But you mentioned the grand jury issue. What about a provision that said this is not prima facie evidence, but it's admissible in the grand jury? That seems to be the crux of the issue, is it?
And Mr. Chair, I don't think we would have a problem with that. And my understanding is that it is admissible in grand juries. I've had preliminary hearings, which is an alternative to grand juries, in Washington County, where the court has found, probable cause, more likely than not, that the state can proceed simply on an officer's testimony that, based on his experience, it was coke. It looked like coke without any test at all being done. And the presiding judge in Washington County found that there was sufficient evidence to hold the defendant over and proceed to trial. So,
but the counter argument to that, and I've been through this numerous times, most deputy district attorneys, the ones that I've dealt with mm-hmm. in Multnomah County, do not like going to a grand jury without having the test done and having a document from the crime lab saying that, in fact, it is what it is. So,
and Mr. Chair, I think that's that's a policy thing, and I think it's sort of an efficiency thing. They get the test done up front and proceed forward.
All right. Okay. So you'll work with Mr. Dugan and to try to. Okay. Help me save some money, Mr. Dugan. You want to?
Mr. Chair, if I may ask, in what direction do you want her to work with me?
Positively.
Not false positively.
I think that from what I'm hearing, there is at least some agreement based on your testimony that the crime lab OSP could save some money by not having to do these tests up front. And I think if there's a way to structure that for the purpose of grand jury and moving the process along, and I think maybe on the line of what Mr. Taylor suggested might work, and then or some specific language that says the defense may request the test be done prior to trial or
that it has to be done.
That language is in the bill.
Is it? Okay. Well, where is it in the bill? Because I didn't see it.
Well, it's in subsection 3B, the prosecution in which the identity of the controlled substance is established using conductive tests, depending upon notice of the district attorney, may request that the controlled substance be sent to the state police forensic laboratory for analysis. And that supported part of the bill was provided.
I'm sorry, I'm not finding section 3.
Line 20. Section 1, subsection 3.
It's lines 20 through 22.
That section is
okay, all right.
Yeah, that section was added because in the current crime lab budget.
Right. But that's not what I was speaking to. I was speaking to the fact that at trial that it would have to have been accomplished. The bill doesn't say that you have to do your confirmatory test.
Mr. Chair, I mean, one proposal would be on line 13 to say it is prima facie evidence for the purposes of grand jury proceedings or preliminary proceedings or something to that effect.
Okay. Well, why don't you guys work with Bill Taylor and see if you can come up with something that would work. I think it makes sense. This committee is going to be taking a little bit more look at some grand jury stuff anyway.
Thank you.
So, thank you very much. So we'll close that little public hearing. Mm-hmm.
Mm. 3317, 3376.
We'll do a joint public hearing on these. We've got Mr. Martinez here from the Bankers Association. And we just sent Ms. Russell out in the hallway. Quick.
Sorry. Charlie leaves and she's out in the hallway.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. 3317 is another one of the four bills I've been talking about dealing with identity theft that has come over from the House. In the House, it did squeak by on the floor on a 52-3 vote, and the three that vote against it, frankly, Senator Ferrioli, were rural Republicans that felt the bill was not necessarily needed. What we're trying to do, again, Oregon is in the top 10 on identity theft cases. It is a continuing problem, a growing problem. 3317 tries to deal with a couple of things. First of all, the new technology. They have these new scanning devices that are about the size of a cigarette pack that merchants or employees of merchants keep in their pockets. When they get your credit card for dinner or for a purchase, they scan it into the machine. The machine then uploads it into their computer, and they sell it over the internet, and they have all your information from your credit card. This happens very, very frequently. Also, we're trying to modernize with financial products. This particular statute did not make reference to debit cards, which is a new technology in the last few years that's out there. So debit cards would be covered by this. Again, we're attempting to develop similar laws in both Oregon and Washington in this area. And Washington did pass this language in their just completed session. And I know what the criminal defense bar is concerned about. They're concerned about the section of the bill that says if you're convicted for a second time, this now becomes a Class B felony. They believe it ought to stay as a Class C, frankly, or as many times as you get caught and go to prison. We disagree with that. We think it ought to be upgraded if they're convicted more than once. And again, when we're trying to make the same law in Washington, we don't want to get somebody who's convicted once in both states and say, okay, I can go back to Oregon and know that if I get caught again, I face the same penalty I did the first time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
There was a thing on TV the other night about people who go to ATMs and put a little gizmo on and it reads your card. Is that what you're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, that's correct.
Well, Mr. Chairman, they didn't say in the story how you tell whether something has been done like that. How do you tell?
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, you can't. I mean, you cannot. If you're in a nice restaurant in Dayton, let's say, and somebody were to do that, you'd have no way of knowing that occurred. And, Mr. Chairman, if I could say one more thing. Senator Ferrioli, I misspoke. I got ahead of myself. The bill that had the three no votes is the next bill we're going to talk about. I apologize for that. This was 52-0 in the House.
Which one was 52-0?
52-0 is this bill.
3317.
All right, because I opened a hearing on both. So, yeah.
The other one was 52 to 3.
Senator Farioli is very mad.
Yes.
And if you wanted me to talk about the other one, I do have some counsel that would like to talk on 3366, if you'd like to hear them, or I can testify on that bill as well.
All right. So, yes, let's hear from your counsel. Okay.
While they're coming up, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez again, Oregon Bankers Association. I'm joined by Dick Rasmussen, who is legal counsel for West Coast Bank, a Oregon state chartered bank. He is also joined, we're joined by John Folon, who's with Lane Powell firm out of Portland and has been counsel for West Coast on some actions under the bill we're talking about. 3366 deals with the statute of frauds. Currently under the statute of frauds, a business loan to be valid must be in writing except for some exceptions. And basically the exceptions are big enough to drive a truck through. We are just clarifying that you must have a written commitment to lend to have a valid loan offer, loan agreement. They're prepared to answer any specific questions, talk a little bit more in detail if the committee desires.
All right. Senator Farrell, any questions? Okay. Gentlemen, you came down here. You might as well share with us this briefly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dick Rasmussen. I'm the, as Mr. Martinez said, the general counsel of the Oregon, West Coast Bank, which is headquartered in Oregon, has about 35 branches here and additional branches in the state of Washington. House Bill 3366 amends the Oregon Statute of Frauds, found at 41580, which requires that certain types of agreements be in writing in order to be enforceable. The primary purpose of the bill is to strengthen the requirement that the commitments to lend money for business purposes be in writing. The problem with the current law is that it is so narrowly drawn it's essentially worthless in the real world under Section 2A of the current of 41580. All defenses and exceptions that have been recognized in connection with other statutes of frauds provisions also apply to loan commitments. This means that all a financially distressed business person has to do to avoid the requirement of a written loan commitment is to claim that the lender made an oral promise to lend and that he relied on it. The bill will close gaping holes in the statute, bringing Oregon in line with Washington and a majority of other states. The bill also eliminates from the statute public education provisions that were fully satisfied in the early 1990s. Anyone who's taken out a commercial loan knows that getting a written loan commitment is an essential part of the process. Closing loopholes in the law will reduce the incidence of frivolous lawsuits that drive up costs of commercial credit and clog the courts. It's important that this bill will have no impact on consumer lending, even though lenders normally issue written commitments to make home loans, oral commitments to make such loans will continue to be enforceable. Be glad
right.
to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Committee, how do you feel about it?
Fine.
Fine. Everybody's fine. Okay. Work session on 3317.
Chairman.
Senator Birdie.
I move House Bill 3317 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Birdie moves House Bill 3317 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Forgive me, Susan. Forgive me. Come on up. Forgive me.
Uh-oh.
No, it's my fault. I'm sorry. I spaced.
Susan Ross, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I can tell that my testimony is going to be very persuasive here, but...
Tim already gave your testimony.
And we have one concern, and that is simply that in page 2, lines 35 through 37, it elevates this crime from a Class C to a Class B felony based on one prior conviction. And it's our position that there should be a requirement of two prior convictions. If we remember with the identity theft statute and other types of repeat offenders, we're not talking about a situation where someone has one prior Class C felony. The identity theft aggravated identity theft got gutted by this committee because of the fiscal impact, but that provision, and I pulled a copy to refresh my recollection, required that the person had two or more previous convictions for identity theft, and it's our position identity theft is really the kind of similar type thing we're talking about here. It's a different way of doing it, but it's that kind of and so it would be
The Criminal Justice Commission is not in this bill directed to put it in any particular category in the sentencing guidelines. So they're still free to weigh that issue, I think.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Right. So, Senator Pritiker.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I hadn't noticed that in the discrepancy with the other one. I think it probably would make sense to make it inconsistent. I still like the bill, Mr. Chairman, but I think she raises a good point. The chairman
questions?
Is blinking.
I've got to argue that I like the Criminal Justice Commission having the ability to put it in sentencing guidelines. I think one of the things that we're going to be facing in the future, the whole issue of identity theft and fraud, is growing exponentially. And the legislature is going to revisit it innumerable times. And this is my personal view. We put people in Measure 11 cases, violent persons, crimes, in prison. But the fraud cases and the property cases are not going there. And frankly, I would submit that that's why we have an explosion of those kind of cases, because criminals, in my opinion, are not unintelligent individuals. In fact, somebody once said they're smarter by accident than they are on purpose. And and they'll figure out a way to make money. And so I like the B felony thing. But we do have a motion in front of us. We can kill the motion or rescind it or whatever.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I think the testimony by Mr. Martinez was that Washington State just passed this law that's almost identical to this with the same kind of penalties, and I was persuaded somewhat by his argument that if you get busted too many times there, you'll just come to Oregon because you got it would be easier.
Yeah,
you get two bites at the apple instead of the one. And he's right. We're number 7 in the nation. I remember the statistics for identity theft, and it costs a hell of a lot of money for people to put their lives back together when someone has done this.
I like Dakota Hammurabi, just whack their hand off.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Ringo.
I'm just clarifying, are we on 3361?
Actually, the motion is on 3317.
The issue, do you know what the issue is, Senator Ringo?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
So there is a motion. Thank you, Susan.
Okay.
God bless you. Have a nice day. And thank you for being
She was persuasive.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. There is the motion. Any further discussion on the motion? There is not. Any objection to the motion? The motion passes. Senator Walker, will you carry that bill?
Sure.
Okay, 3366. Everybody okay on that one? We'll do a work session for 3366. Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 3366 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 3366 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Mr. Martinez talked to me briefly about this yesterday, and I guess I was expecting more of a hearing today. Did we already have a hearing on this bill?
We did, actually. And we had several.
It was compelling, Senator.
Several lawyers and Mr.
I will defer them. I will defer.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion on the motion? Or we have a motion. Do we have a motion yet?
We have a motion.
Gosh, I'm losing this morning. It's like, all right. Do pass motion. Further discussion? No discussion. Any objections? There are no objections. Motion passes. Thank you very much. And Senator Farioli.
I like this comment.
Pleasure, Mr.
Chair.
Statute of frauds. Now, did the Republicans vote against that one?
I don't think so.
Okay, and then we got a couple of
rural Republicans.
Representative Anderson, you have appeared. We already had your bill earlier, and had our way with it, and it's kind of on hold. Do you want to share with us anything? The committee has some issues with it. So, I'll certainly take your testimony here. against House 3520.
Oh, thank you. We're trying to keep up with you on TV this morning. You're bouncing around a little bit. I can understand that.
It's getting that time of season.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. There is one minor change that needs to be made on this, possibly. Brad Swink was going to be here. I don't know whether he was.
He did. He just
he was.
Dumped
all
over the thing.
All right. Well, let me give you a little of the background. For the record, I'm Gordon Anderson, representative from District 3. I am here to appear today in support of House Bill 3520, which was filed by a constituent of mine, a very close friend, who was troubled by the fact that last year when she went to court for a seatbelt ticket, the defendant, whose case was heard before her, was allowed to go to a diversion class to be taught about the importance of wearing seatbelts, safety belts. She was allowed this only after pleading guilty to the offense. Mrs. Delphi, however, was not allowed to take the class after her conviction because she pled innocent to the violation, a decision she based on certain circumstances in her case that she believed were unfair. She had, in fact, had the seatbelt around her waist and under her arm because of comfort, and it is the law to have it over your shoulder. She did not know that. She was told that she could not take the class because she had been found guilty and not pled guilty. She believed, as I do, that this violates the spirit of the educational program, which is designed to get more people educated on the importance of properly wearing their seat belts. The intent was not to force people to make a decision between giving up their right to a trial and having the option to attend class. This bill would correct the problem that Ms. Delphi faced and many others in our state face as well. It does so by clarifying for judges what rights they possess as far as these classes are concerned. It adds one simple idea in two simple sentences. At any time prior to the entry of judgment of a conviction of a violation of the seatbelt law, the court may offer an educational or remedial program to the defendant. Upon successful completion of the program and payment of all fees imposed as part of the program, the court may dismiss the complaint. There has been discussion over what all fees means, and it was my understanding, and you may have heard, that Mr. Swink and myself agreed last night that if it was unitary fees so that the courts are made whole and also program fees for the schooling, that would be reasonable. This bill passed the Judiciary Committee on the House side 9-0. It passed the floor 59-0. And I feel that it's a good bill, and I hope there will be some consideration or reconsideration on this bill. Great. Thank you for the chance to come and present to you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Walker, do you want to have your way with the
I'm sorry, Representative, but I don't like your bill and thought, you know, it was well-intended, but I just don't think we need diversion for seatbelt violators. And just, you know, I appreciate your explanation, and I just don't think we need it.
Of course, we're good at making silk out of a sow's ear here.
Well, thank you for your chance to please present.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate your time.
Any other questions?
We'll close the public hearing then on 3520. And we've got one last bill here, 3544, public hearing. I assume, Mr. Fuller, you're here for this bill. Being a detective and having a keen sense of the obvious, it says Oregon Auto Dealers Association. All of my cognitive skills are not lost. Standing effect of session spiraling out of control.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Please ignore the first couple of paragraphs of my testimony, which apologize for my inability to be here this morning, as in fact I am here. I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to make it and thought I may have to just turn in some testimony prior to the committee starting. House Bill 3544 is a compromise between the auto dealers and the Bureau of Labor of Industries that we negotiated on the House side. Some of my dealers had come under a problem with the current penalty wage law, which if you do not pay somebody who's separated their service from your business, you have to pay them all the wages they are due within a very short period of time. And if you don't, The penalty is an extra 30 days' wages for failure to pay everything on time. In a commission-based industry, we often don't know what commissions they're going to earn in that period of time. And we ran into a situation where employees who believed they were owed some money would actually file asking for a lot more than they actually were owed. And regardless of the amount that a court awarded them, they were in a situation where they had to pay the full 30 days penalty wage, even if the amount that was awarded in court was relatively minor. The bill, as it was originally introduced, was much broader than what you have with you today. I had a chance to meet with staff from the Bureau of Labor of Industries who explained how our original bill would have had unanticipated consequences on other businesses. So we narrowed it down to just commission-based people who sell automobiles, trucks, and farm implements. There's still a penalty for not paying the employee everything that they are owed, but if the amount that the court awards is less than $200 or less than 20% of what they claimed they owed, which would be an indication that they were claiming a lot that they didn't that they had not earned, that the penalty would simply be twice the amount owed plus costs as opposed to a full 30-day penalty wage. My understanding is that the Farm Bureau is here today with an amendment. Dash A2 amendments, which both the Bureau of Labor and Industries and I have had a chance to review, and we have no opposition to the amendments, which simply allow for hand delivery of payment as opposed to mailing a final paycheck to make sure that it's clear that the final paycheck can be hand delivered. With that, I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill at all. I appreciated working with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and their willingness to carve out an exception for commission-based employees under these circumstances, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you have.
All right, thank you very much. And we do have an A2 amendment, Farm Bureau. I assume it's Farm Bureau. You want to talk, say anything about it? Like the, why don't you do it for the record? Just open.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, Oregon Farm Bureau, members of the committee. I apologize, Mr. Chairman, but quite understand your comment there.
I'm not understanding.
Apologize for being late here. yes, Farm Bureau does support the amendment. It's what intended to be a friendly amendment. We had worked on this particular section of the bill about 4 years ago, dealing with farm employees and how they're paid or not paid, and what the wage penalty is if they are not paid on time. We have no problem, of course, with the main portion of the bill. It doesn't affect us, but it did change that portion that we worked on before. And we just wanted to make sure that hand delivery of checks counted as well.
Right. Senator Ringo?
Is there anybody from Boley who's going to testify on this?
I guess we do have Boley here. Okay. They're not signed up, but come on up and share with us.
Good morning, Chairman, as members of the committee. My name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I support or I concur with what Mr. Fuller and Mr. Schellenberg have already presented, and the Bureau does support the bill as currently written and the amendments submitted by the Farm Bureau. I'm just here to answer any questions you might have about the bill.
What are you have a question? Okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, the purpose of the penalty clause is to address what has been a constant abuse by employers and continues. And, you know, it's only a few bad apples that creates the problem. But that is where the employer just says, well, goodbye. And I owe you some wages. Well, that's your problem. And since the wages are only a couple hundred dollars, you know, it's hard for that person to get redress, because what are they going to do? Go to small claims court? Well, maybe, but that's a fight. Are they going to go hire a lawyer? Is a lawyer going to take that? You know, that's why there's attorney fees for these kinds of claims. But I do want to ensure that people that are wrongfully deprived wages still have a mechanism whereby they can get paid. So can you assure me that this bill doesn't impact them?
Chairman, as Senator Ringo, yes. As amended, the Bureau feels comfortable with the provisions of this bill. It is limited to commissioned salespeople only. And there is also a clause on the second page of the bill in subparagraph 5 where the employer cannot benefit by the reduction in the penalty wages if the employer has willfully violated the provisions of the final payment provisions one or more times in the year before the particular employment situation.
I mean, you said it only applies to commissioned salesmen. I mean, I think, frankly, they're particularly susceptible to abuse because often the commissions don't come in after a period of time. It depends what sort of business it is. Can you articulate again why we need the changes for commissioned salespersons?
Chair Minnis, Senator Ringo, the Bureau did not propose this legislation. We did work with the Auto Dealers Association, which did propose the legislation, and they explained to us that their concern was with regard to commissioned salespeople, where the amount of commissions was not always known at the date of termination. And this legislation codifies the Bureau's current policy that unpaid commissions are not due until certain conditions are met. And if the employment agreement provides for certain conditions to be met before the commissions are due, such as the customer has to pay the cost of, pay for the cost of the vehicle before the commission is due, we say that's an enforceable agreement between the employer and the employee, and the commissions aren't due at the time the employee terminates their employment if those conditions haven't been met. So we are recognizing that commissioned employees are somewhat different than non-commissioned employees that are paid on an hourly or a salary basis.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, Mr. Fuller, how long after the termination of an employee in your business is it reasonable to expect that the amount of the commission ought to be known?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, in most cases, it is determined probably within a matter of probably 3 to 5 business days. There are circumstances in which we put out customers in cars that are contingent on financing, and until the lending institutions approve the financing of that vehicle, we don't know if the sale is good or not. There's another bill that's going through this process now that tries to narrow that gap to less than 20 days, but there are cases where it's 20 and 30 days out before we can get a lending institution to approve a contract because of part of the circumstances in somebody's credit history, or once they start working on the credit history, the person says that they were employed for 3 years at some place, and the place of employment says they were only there for 2 years, and there are certain things that have to be rectified before a lending institution will fund the deal. And so there are circumstances where we don't know when that commission is earned. And when that commission is earned, we ought to pay it to the employee that has left service. The problem is, if it's 20 or 30 days later, then we've violated the law, and we have to pay them an extra 30 days' wages if they file suit.
Okay. In your presentation of this bill, one of the reasons that you stated was that the employee may make an exaggerated claim or just claim way too much, and so that then they shouldn't benefit if they only receive a small portion of that. I mean, one of the reasons they may receive a small portion is because of something beyond their control. It's not because they improperly exaggerated the claim.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, that may be the case. What was brought to my attention that initiated the bill were circumstances where employees were shooting for the moon, if you will, based on the notion that if a court were to find that the employer owed them anything, they would not only get what they were owed plus interest plus court costs, but a full extra 30 days penalty, and that gave an incentive for an employee to shoot for the moon, suggesting that the employer is better off paying mm-hmm. what the employee asks, even though it's not owed, because it's cheaper to pay off the employee than to litigate and prove that only a small amount was owed, and then to have to pay 30 days extra wages for proving that the employer was right in court.
We don't want to condone extortion, but
And there's still, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rubio, there's still a penalty of double the amount that's owed, even in the exception that we've carved here, where it's less than $200 or less than 20% of what has occurred, there's still a doubling of the penalty. So they're not getting eliminating a penalty against the employer in those cases. We're simply, as I've indicated in my written testimony, trying to make the punishment more appropriately fit the crime, if you will. And again, as the Bureau of Labor and Industries has testified, if an employer has violated this sort of agreement at all in the previous year, then they don't qualify for this exception at all. They've got to have a clean history with bullying in order to take advantage of this exception.
All right. Any further testimony? Anyone else wishing to testify on 3544? If not, we're going to close the public hearing, and we're going to adjourn. We'll bring this back for work session some other time. All right. Thank you. And thank you. Good work, guys. We're finished. Started late, but...